We're going to call the House Rules Committee to order. Our quorum is here, which is appropriate and nice. These days are getting busier and busier. And with that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2839. And we're going to have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. HB 2839 allows either party entering into a domestic partnership to retain the surname or to change the surname to the surname of the other party or a hyphenated combination of surnames of both parties. It also adds an exception to circumstances under which a domestic partnership is prohibited and void. In 2007, the Legislative Assembly enacted HB 2007 dealing with domestic partnerships. That bill became Chapter 99 of Oregon Laws 2007. That act was the subject of a 2007 referendum petition that failed to obtain the necessary signatures to place the initiative on the 2008 general election ballot. Chapter 99 therefore took effect January 1, 2008, but did not have ORS chapter and section numbers assigned at the time the 2007 edition of the revised statutes was compiled and published in late 2007. The text, however, of that statute may be found in a note following ORS 106.990. HB 2839 proposes several changes to the provisions of Chapter 99, Oregon Laws 2007. It changes the surname options available to the parties to a domestic partnership and provides a mechanism by which the selected surname is indicated on the Declaration of Domestic Partnership. That's my summary.
Thank you very much. And with that, we will begin with Representative Tina Kotek and Senator Vicki Walker. And it's so good to see you so quickly after our last testimony in the last committee, Senator Walker. I appreciate you being here.
This has been a busy day, Mr. Chair, and you have one chair in this committee. Okay, we do a lot of co-chair stuff. Bob Jensen and I do, and so it's kind of nice. I haven't been in this hearing room for a while, so it's great to be here. I'll start since I'm already yakking. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Last session, I came in while Mr. Watson, I'll be darned, you're the committee administrator. Hi, Jerry. I didn't know that. That's cool. So I don't know what Mr. Watson explained to you. I heard some of it, but last session, I co-opted a little bill that Representative Thatcher had, and it wasn't done mean-spiritedly, and I just added some things to it. And it was House Bill 3120. And it just had a nice relating clause. And I had read an article in Ms. Magazine, some of you may know that magazine, about men who wanted to take the surnames of their wife upon marriage, and they weren't allowed to do that in some states. And in many states, actually, they had to do it by paying a fee and going through a name change. So I thought that was kind of dumb, and just to, you know, put it eloquently. And so I changed the law. And you guys had some spirited discussion about that on the floor, and it barely passed, which was just kind of amazing to me. Some of the comments that I won't repeat, but it was interesting. Well, anyway, the domestic partnership bill, as you know, was traveling through the legislature around that time as well. And I thought for certain that House Bill 3120 would have taken care of this provision to allow domestic partners to take the surname of their domestic partner. And it did not. So I drafted a bill. I drafted Senate Bill 346 because I like to clean up my messes. And Senate Bill 346 would have done what you will see before you today in House Bill 2839. And since Representative Kotek and others had already moved forward on 2839 and had the same provisions that I had in my bill, I decided to just let mine go away quietly and just become paper. So that's all I'm here to testify about. I understand there were some other issues around the domestic partnership bill that needed to be taken care of because some of my constituents had talked with me. I assume those are all what you see in the bill today. And so I would urge your support of this piece of legislation to tidy up the bow and make this new law work the way we all had intended it to do and to give rights to domestic partners that other couples who marry have. So, as we all know, it's a domestic partnership, not a marriage. I will state that very clearly for the record. Anyway, that's why I'm here, and that's why I drafted that language. Do you have any questions? No, I just
okay.
So succinct. That's
yeah,
great.
That's right.
All right. Well, I've got another committee, so I'll move along while Representative Kotek holds down the fort. Thank you very much.
Thank you very
right,
much.
Good afternoon, committee. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 2839. Wanted to publicly thank Senator Walker as well for working on these issues and her advocacy on behalf of domestic partnerships. The bill we have today before you is a housekeeping bill intended to address some unintended consequences from legislation we passed in the 2007 session. As the Oregon Family Fairness Act was implemented over the past year, that was House Bill 2007 from the previous session, same-sex couples encountered a few problems stemming from the interaction of state and federal law and its effect on same-sex couples. This bill is a common-sense fix. It will clarify the intent of the Oregon Family Fairness Act with minor technical adjustments. The first issue brings uniformity to the name change process, similar to what Senator Walker was talking about. Under current law, Oregon domestic partners have to undergo a different process to change their last names than do married couples. This is confusing and problematic for the couples and government agencies alike. This bill creates a uniform and streamlined process for domestic partners seeking a name change. Secondly, current Oregon statute contains a confusing provision for domestically partnered couples whose relationship may be recognized in another state. This bill eliminates confusion and any unintended consequences in Oregon's domestic partnership law. This change ensures that all caring and committed couples will be able to take care of their families in times of need. And finally, you will have before you a Dash 1 amendment to this bill. The Dash 1 amendment is in response to some issues that have been raised by my constituents as well as other constituents for other members in the state here. The Dash 1 amendment to this bill would retain a tax practice that has been in effect since 1999. Gay couples have to pay federal taxes on their benefits provided to their partner through their employer. It's one of the problems with the disconnect with federal law. Since 1999, Oregon has provided a deduction for these benefits under the Tanner decision, which was a legal decision back in the late 90s. Last year, the Oregon Department of Revenue determined that House Bill 2007 required a revision of the tax code regarding this deduction. Unfortunately, this created some confusion and a disruption for those using the deduction. This bill, the amendment, would eliminate the confusion and preserve a well-established tax practice that has been in place since 1999, by simply creating a bridge for tax year 2008. And we have been in consultation around this amendment with Department of Revenue and Legislative Council. You will be seeing another amendment. We have realized that while the intent is to take care of folks who have been taking the tax deduction, it doesn't quite get there, but the intent is what's in my testimony. We will have a different amendment for you, but at least you get a sense of what we're trying to capture in the amendment. You're going to hear testimony today that goes into greater detail on all these proposed changes. I am not the expert, and we have some folks lined up for you. But I just want to thank you for your time and consideration of this bill and urge your support and full support of the amendment when we have it before you. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Representative? Why did they go to Mike Gelser? That's
thank
pretty
you,
amazing. I was thinking Gelser the whole last 2 hours.
Well, it was finally an opportunity to relieve your mind of that
That's
thought.
That's right. There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kotek, in the Dash 1 amendment, as you talk to your colleagues, are they, at a previous time, I had been talking with some of my constituents who were having a difficult time finding instructions and their ability to claim this on the Oregon tax form. Would this make that more accessible, and are you aware of whether or not the Department of Revenue has improved the accessibility of this option to gay and lesbian couples who are wanting to take advantage of the subtraction so that they know that it exists?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser. Because of, and what you'll hear from other folks here today, because of the interpretation of the department, because of the changes from House Bill 2007, any reference to being able to take this imputed benefit deduction on your tax form has been removed, and the line is off the tax form now, which is part of the issue that people are noticing. There was lack of communication, but it was also very difficult to know which couples were taking advantage of the deduction through the Tanner decision. And so, but if we move forward with the amendment, then we will make every effort to communicate to those couples, hopefully before they file their taxes. All my guess is they would have to file some amended version.
And may I follow up?
Please.
Thank you. And I'm thinking about a situation that I worked on with one of my constituents, and this was before the domestic partnerships law. The challenge that they ran into when they filed it was that they were asked to prove that they were, in fact, a gay couple, and they were unsure what would constitute proof of that. With the passage of the domestic partnerships legislation, would that certificate of domestic partnership fulfill that requirement of proof?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gelser, that would be my assumption, but we will have, if we needed clarification, I can ask the Department of Revenue folks who are here. But now that we are able to register as domestic partners in the state, and thank you, colleagues, for helping us do that, that would signify as the document. Yes, I think it was probably unclear before, but now that we have an official recognition, it's a lot more clear.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel, Paul Weiss, Dana Singer, and Beth Allen. Did I miss?
No, she's my partner.
Okay, very good, no problem. And you can take whichever order you want.
Okay,
Paul.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today. For the record, my name is Paul Weiss. I am a resident of Florence, Oregon, in the chair's district, and I am a gay American. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 2839. My partner Donnie and I recently celebrated our 10-year anniversary. For the past decade, we've been in a caring and committed relationship. We share finances, we've owned property together, we live together in sickness and health, sharing both the joys and the responsibilities of a long-term commitment to each other. In 2003, while living in California, Donnie and I sought legal protection for our relationship and registered as domestic partners in the state of California. By doing so, we made a personal and legal commitment to one another and became a family recognized by the state of California. Then 2 years ago, in 2007, we moved to Oregon. I wanted to spend more time with my aging parents who live in Florence. I'm a librarian currently working remotely for the Sage Library Consortium in Eastern Oregon. We moved to Oregon despite the fact that our California domestic partnership is only expressly valid in the state of California. We realize now that this move stripped us of literally hundreds of rights, responsibilities, and legal protections for our family. So naturally, we were pleased and relieved in 2007 when the Oregon legislature passed House Bill 2007, the Oregon Family Fairness Act, creating Oregon registered domestic partnerships for committed same-sex couples. And thank you to those members of the committee who voted for this legislation. At first, we didn't even think about the implications of our move on our domestic partnership, just as straight married couples don't usually think about the impact of a move on their legal marriage. At some point, it occurred to us that we'd better look into the status. From what we could tell, Oregon indeed did not recognize domestic partnerships from other states, so we had yet more paperwork and expense that straight married couples do not face. As we investigated registering in Oregon, we became confused and then nervous, because Section 41A states that, quote, a domestic partnership is prohibited or void when either part to the domestic partnership had a partner, wife, or husband living at the time of the domestic partnership, unquote. So, does this mean that Donnie and I cannot register as Oregon domestic partners because we have a legally valid California domestic partnership? If we did register in Oregon now, would we be actually violating state law? Would Oregon annul the domestic partnership if the state found out about our California domestic partnership? To do this legally in Oregon's eyes, would we need to void our relationship, in essence get a divorce in California? If many couples did this, that would lead to inaccurate statistics about the longevity of gay relationships. Or what about gay couples who moved to Oregon from Vermont? Vermont requires residency in order to dissolve a civil union. Would these couples have to return to Vermont, live there for a full year in order to dissolve their relationship, and then move back to Oregon to register? We, of course, realize that House Bill 2839 won't fix all the challenges that same-sex couples face in this bifurcated system of relationship recognition. It won't do anything to make sure that Donnie and I have protections if we move out of the state. It won't make it possible for Donnie and I to file joint federal income taxes. It won't give us access to any of the 1,138 rights and responsibilities the federal government denies our relationship. However, it will give us peace of mind that we can enter into an Oregon registered domestic partnership and not have it deemed invalid because of our California domestic partnership. It will clarify that we don't need to go through dissolution in California to be valid in Oregon. We look forward to a legally recognized relationship in Oregon as one more step we have taken over the years to protect one another and take responsibility for one another. Please support House Bill 2839. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we'll go through the whole panel and we'll ask questions. So whoever's next.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify before you today. For the record, my name is Dana Singer. I'm here with my partner, Nathalie Frenner, and we are residents of Eugene, Oregon. I am here to ask you to support House Bill 2839. Nathalie and I have been together for 4 years, and we have three terrific children. Amber is 23, Alexandria is 10, and Alexandria is 13, and Andrew's 10. Amber graduated from UC Davis and is trying to get into vet school. The younger ones love school, playing basketball through the Y and Jim Carrey movies like any other kids. Together, Nathalie and I and our kids are a family, just like any other family. We share the joys and responsibilities of raising a family in Oregon. The state of Oregon, under the confines of ballot measure 36, does not legally recognize the marriages of same-sex couples. We remain hopeful that one day the voters of Oregon will see fit to remove this language from our state constitution. In the meantime, Nathalie and I have gone to great lengths to gain legal protections for our family. Over the years, we have spent thousands of dollars on attorney's fees just to have a little peace of mind that we can take care of each other and our children. Call us old-fashioned, but we really wanted to get married to celebrate our commitment and love for each other. So in 2007, before Oregon's domestic partnership law went into effect, our family traveled to Canada, where we were married by a justice of the peace. We were excited when the legislature passed House Bill 2007 and created domestic partnerships for caring and committed couples. We all attended the governor's signing ceremony on the steps of the Capitol in May 2007. And thank you to those members of the committee who voted in favor of this bill. But since then, as we have considered the pros and cons of registering as domestic partners in Oregon, we have become nervous about one line in the bill, the one which indicates that a domestic partnership can be voided if we are already partnered or married. We don't know how to interpret that. We understand that our Canadian marriage is not legally valid in the eyes of Oregon law. So does that mean we can get a domestic partnership even though we're married in the eyes of Canadian law? Or would that put us and our kids at risk? When it comes to protecting our family, we're not willing to take any chances. Many gay and lesbian couples go to great lengths to legally validate their relationships in the eyes of the law. This means many of us have several certificates hanging over the mantle and attempt to cobble together a patchwork of legal protections for our partners and our families. Please vote in favor of House Bill 2839 in order to make it clear that couples like ours who have marriages in other jurisdictions can still register as domestic partners in Oregon without putting our families at risk. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify in favor of House Bill 2839. My name is Beth Allen. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland, and my firm, Allen Squared Law, specializes in serving gay and lesbian Oregonians, and we have extensive experience counseling same-sex couples on issues related to domestic partnerships and family law. HB 2839 clarifies a provision of the Oregon Family Fairness Act that addresses the circumstances when an Oregon domestic partnership is deemed void or valid. Also, the bill permits same-sex partners to take new legal name upon domestic partnership in a manner that's consistent with changes that were made regarding name changes for married couples in 2007. And House Bill 2839 provides some fine-tuning of the Oregon Family Fairness Act, and it makes it more fair. The Oregon Family Fairness Act states, as you've heard, that a domestic partnership is void when, quote, when either party to a domestic partnership has a partner, wife, or husband living at the time of the domestic partnership. That language muddies the water for those couples who, with one another, have entered into marriages or domestic partnerships legally recognized in other jurisdictions. And as you've heard, Oregon gay and lesbian couples or couples moving to Oregon often have other legal recognitions from other states as domestic partnerships, civil unions, or even marriages. Now, Oregon courts are required to interpret statutes strictly. If it's not ambiguous on its face, the judge must interpret it as it is written, even if the legislature intended something else entirely. On its face, couples may not register if either or both of them has any existing marriage or registered domestic partnership, even if it is to one another. Although it might seem pretty obvious that the intention in adding the above-quoted language was to prohibit a couple from registering if one of the persons in the couple was already married, registered, or in a civil union with someone else, a good argument could be made that it says what it says. And you can count on it that a lawyer will try to make that argument. You can't already have a wife, husband, or partner, period. HB 2839 makes it clear that an Oregon registered domestic partnership is valid even if the couple is partnered or married in another jurisdiction, so long as the domestic partnership or marriage is between the same two people. This could be, without the bill, this could be a problem for many Oregon couples who have domestic partnerships, marriages, or perhaps even civil unions in other jurisdictions. For Paul and his partner and Dana and her partner, both of whom have also testified before you today, this confusion could have real and serious consequences. I'd like to play out a potential scenario for you that could apply to, for example, couples like Paul and Donnie. Let's say after, as he said, several years together, they register their domestic partnership in California. Then they move to Oregon. And let's say that they register as domestic partners. And let's say that Paul has been a high income wage earner for years as Donnie helped put him through medical school. That would be nice. So Donnie just worked part-time odd jobs that allowed him to make sure that Paul's free time was not spent caring for the homeowner's basic needs. The two had agreed to this arrangement, but never had written it down as a contract. As it turns out, Paul hates the weather and leaves Don for the sunny skies of Florida. Sorry. Donnie files for dissolution of the registration in Oregon and seeks spousal support. He asks the court to apply what's called the presumption of equal contribution. That's a presumption legal presumption that says that married couples are assumed or presumed to have contributed equally to those assets that they have acquired during their marriage. And most of these assets, of course, are in Paul's name because he's the one who's making all the money. Don asks for attorney fees. Again, something that's permitted under the statutes for married couples and for registered couples. So Paul, though, counters, well, they're not registered in Oregon because they were already registered in California at the time they filed the registration. Therefore, Donnie had a partner at the time they filed the registration, and that, therefore, the Oregon registration is void. That's exactly what the language appears to have happened. If the court agrees, Donnie may lose out on some of the essential benefits of the Oregon Family Fairness Act. I can give to you a broad range of scenarios. They include situations where a domestic partner assumes that the intestate succession statutes would apply, but a family member comes in and says, no, that's not a valid registration. Therefore, me, the real family member, gets to keep all the assets that are in the deceased partner's name. I thought of scenarios involving children as well, where a family member could come in and say that's not actually a step parent at all if they don't follow through with an adoption, which frankly many couples don't do. They rely on the registration to protect their family and could potentially have a situation where a family member takes away the child from their other mother. I won't talk about the name change. I think that's been well covered by the previous testimony. So I will close and I'll be open to questions. Thank you for your time, and I urge you to pass HB 2839.
Any questions for this group? I guess the thing I just want to say is thank you, because the wording, it was confusing to me on line 15 and 16, why we put that other part in. Now it makes total sense. Previous, it did not make sense. I was reading it twice, and it was kind of like, what is this saying? But your clarification has made it clear to me that it is making sure that we understand if they're in a domestic partnership with the same person, it's still okay. So I appreciate that a lot.
Thank you. Glad we could help.
Our next panel, Dan Yonker and, let me make sure, Keith Cutler. Go ahead, whoever wants to go first.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify for you today on HB 2839. My name is Dan Yonker, and I serve as the Finance and Operations Director for Basic Rights Oregon. Basic Rights Oregon is the statewide advocacy organization for the gay, transgender, and allied community. We represent tens of thousands of Oregonians from every corner of the state. We were proud to work with the legislature 2 years ago to secure passage of the Oregon Family Fairness Act, creating domestic partnership protections for same-sex couples. Basic Rights Oregon is committed to ensuring that this law is fully implemented and achieves its purpose. HB 2839 is a modest bill that fixes three technical glitches in Oregon's registered domestic partnership law. I'm here to address the item related to the tax code. I have testimony submitted by Mark Clift, a certified public accountant and principal at McDonald Jacobs, which I will read into the record and then take any questions that you may have. I am a certified public accountant and managing partner of McDonald Jacobs PC. McDonald Jacobs PC is an accounting and consulting firm with clients throughout the Pacific Northwest. Founded in 1972, we have a staff of more than 25 experienced professionals supporting businesses and individuals from our offices in downtown Portland. Our firm has many LGBT clients, and I am very familiar with the treatment of same-sex couples under Oregon tax law. I am writing in support of HB 2839, and in particular the section of the bill that preserves a tax deduction available to same-sex couples prior to 2008 in Oregon who are taxed on benefits provided to their partner through their employer. And I'm going to let you read the details of what he's written. So I'll just summarize at the end and say, because there was no well-publicized announcement of the change in treatment, domestic partners had no real notice of loss of the medical insurance deduction until they tried to file their tax returns after year. I didn't hear about it until I saw the Registered Domestic Partner webpage on the Oregon Department of Revenue website, and that was in January of 2009. If a CPA who has a large GLBT practice isn't aware of it, it's unlikely that domestic partners or their employers would have been aware of it either. HB 2839 is a reasonable solution for an unintended consequence of the Oregon Family Fairness Act. Passing this bill will help preserve a well-established tax practice that has been in place since 1999. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Go right ahead. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Keith Cutler. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. I'm here basically to answer any questions you may have specifically about the Dash 1 amendments. As Representative Kotek indicated at the outset, however, you're going to see a different version of Dash 1 amendments eventually. So I'd be happy to address any questions you have about it now, about what I understand may be coming before you, or we can wait until you have those in front of you, as you wish.
I'll just ask. The Dash 1s basically have to do with the Tanner decision and making sure this tax credit is back. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The problem that's trying to be addressed is that until the effective date of the Oregon Family Fairness Act, pursuant to the Tanner decision and a rule promulgated by the Department of Revenue, same-sex domestic partners were able to subtract from their federal income the value of their employer-paid benefits. With the effective date of the Act, which was, I believe, around February 1st of 2008, it was delayed a little bit because of a court challenge that had stayed it. With the effective date of the Act, in order to obtain those benefits now, the TANA rationale and that earlier rule, which still applies for everyone through January of 08, no longer applies. Now, in order to obtain the benefit, you either have to be a married person or a registered domestic partner. The problem that I understand came to light is that not all same-sex domestic partners who were taking that benefit as of January of 08 realized that in order to continue to get it continuously for all of 2008, they would have had to have registered in February. So there may be some who had the benefit up through January of 08 who may not have registered until, who knows, maybe even December of 2008. And my understanding is that the goal of this amendment is to address that bridge and provide them a bridge so that they don't have any discontinuity in being able to take that subtraction.
And along that line, if they were concerned about the other provision in here that didn't allow them to, if they had a domestic partnership in some other state, they weren't sure if it would be null and void by getting another domestic partnership, they would probably have waited till that got fixed, but then they would have lost the other one because they weren't in a domestic partnership. So there was kind of a catch-22 with regard to the interpretation, if I understand that correctly.
Mr. Chair, that's certainly possible.
Okay. Questions for any of our? And we will have to wait and see what comes of our amendment, but we look forward to that fairly soon. So thank you both.
Thank you.
That is the total of the So is there anyone else here who was just decided they came today and they needed to testify that they weren't? I see no one else. Thank you very much, and we will close our public hearing on House Bill 2839. And with that, we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2005. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2005 requires chief petitioners on a prospective petition for a state measure to file a statement declaring whether persons will be paid for obtaining elector signatures. It requires paid signature gatherers on prospective initiative petitions to register with the Secretary of State and complete a training program. It requires the Department of State Police to provide the Secretary of State with information concerning the criminal background of applicants for registration, prohibits paid signature gatherers from obtaining signatures at the same time on the on a petition or prospective petition for which the person is not being paid, directs the Secretary of State to prepare official templates for cover and signature sheets for prospective petitions for state measures, requires the use of those official templates by signature gatherers. It requires chief petitioners to file signature sheets with Secretary of State on a monthly basis. Allows the Secretary of State to begin signature verification if the Secretary determines that at least 50% of the total number of signatures required in state initiative petitions has been filed. And prohibits the Secretary of State from counting petition signatures obtained by persons who have been convicted of certain crimes or are subject to penalties under ORS 260.993 or ORS 260.995. In terms of background, the state constitution of Oregon was adopted in 1857 by a vote of more than 2-1. That constitution was not amended till 1902 when the voters approved an amendment establishing the initiative and referendum process for approving both statutory measures and subsequent constitutional amendments. This made changing the constitution easier. The initiative process gives direct legislative power to the voters to enact new laws, change existing laws, or amend the Oregon Constitution. Since 1902, the Oregon Constitution has been amended more than 100 times. The initiative process has been used more frequently in recent decades than it was used previously. For an initiative to qualify for the next general election, chief petitioners must receive written approval from the Secretary of State to circulate signature sheets in order to collect signatures from registered voters. They must obtain the necessary number of valid signatures and submit them to the Secretary of State no later than 4 months prior to the date of the next generally scheduled general election. During the 2007 Legislative Assembly, the Legislative Assembly adopted HB 2082, a measure making a number of changes in Oregon's initiative process. Among other provisions, that bill required paid signature gatherers to register and complete training. And HB 2082 also prohibited persons convicted of fraud, forgery, or identity theft within the previous 5 years from being paid signature gatherers.
Thank you very much. And before we get started, I just want to kind of go over what we're going to be doing the next two of our meetings. Today we're going to start with Senate Bill 2005, and we're going to just get kind of our briefing from some invited testimony, Secretary of State's office. And so we have that in context, because when I look through all of the bills that we're going to have that have to do with initiative reform, this one, parts of others are in this one, and I just wanted to get a lay of the land. Next, on Friday, we'll have public testimony for 2005, and we'll have some more information between now and then, and a couple other bills that people want to hear. And then on Monday of next week, I think we have 8 bills. All of them have to do with the initiative process. So there's a lot of stuff that came to us on the initiative process. I want to give people an opportunity to look and have their say on each different thing and aspect of that. Some of them are statutory like this. Others are constitutional. In the end, I expect we'll have a couple things that come through here. But I wanted to make sure that we took an adequate amount of time to have a real discussion and understanding of what these issues are. So that's kind of how it's organized, and I appreciate your attentiveness in being here. And just so other people know, we have a couple members who have another committee that's starting up at 4:30, so they may have to leave in the middle of this if we're not done by then. So that's just to let you people know. And I also wanted to make sure that our witnesses had a chance to take a deep breath, because they seem to be rushing to get here on time, because we went quickly from one bill to the other, and obviously they are watching on TV. So hopefully they got a deep breath, they're relaxed and ready to go forward. And with that, the only thing person that looks like that I might be missing is Summer Davis. Oh, she's here too? Okay. You're welcome to sit up with these distinguished people as well, or you can... So with that...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kate Brown, Oregon's Secretary of State. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today and for hearing House Bill 2005. This bill is our omnibus initiative reform package. It's what I see as an extension of the work this legislature began in 2007 with the passage of House Bill 2082. Fondly known as IRMA, the Initiative Reform Modernization Act. As I traveled across the state, I heard from Oregonians time and time again that we needed to reform our initiative system and restore the confidence of Oregon voters. Recent polling confirms what I heard from Oregonians. Nearly three-quarters of voters, 73%, think changes in the system are needed. While the initiative system is an important part of our political DNA, it's important that we restore the confidence of Oregonians in the system. My focus today is on the process. My job as your Secretary of State is to ensure the method of petitioning our government is fair and free from fraudulent means. Of the 24 states that use some form of direct democracy, we are among the least restrictive. This has made our state a testing ground for special interests, spending millions of dollars pursuing their narrow political agendas. So, the goal of House Bill 2005 is to close loopholes, fine-tune the work we did last session, and to provide the Attorney General and me with a few more tools to enforce the law. With the passage of this bill, citizens can petition their government for change, and Oregonians will have the confidence that initiatives they vote on were brought to the ballot legally and legitimately. Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is go through the highlights of House Bill 2005, do a section-by-section analysis, and then I'm going to turn it over to Margaret Olney. She's with the Department of Justice, the Attorney General's Office. We've been working closely in preparation of this bill, and then we'd like to answer questions from the committee if that's appropriate. All right. In terms of highlights, first of all, House Bill 2005 forbids the counting of signatures on petitions collected by anyone convicted of fraud, forgery, or identity theft. It gives elections officials in our Secretary of State's office access to the Oregon State Police database to check the criminal history of paid signature gatherers. It requires petitioners to turn in original sheets once a month, providing more time for elections officials to verify signatures and more time for petitioners to address inadequate numbers of signatures. It allows the Secretary of State's office to begin verifying signatures once a petition has received reached the 50% of the number required to qualify in terms of signatures. It allows concurrent civil and criminal enforcement of elections violations relating to initiatives. It authorizes the Secretary of State to pull petitions collected by a circulator who's not been properly registered or has been found liable for certain civil or criminal election offenses. That's paid signature gatherers. It makes chief petitioners liable when they should have known that a circulator broke the law. The law now establishes liability only when the chief petitioner has actual knowledge. It bars paid circulators from collecting signatures as volunteers at the same time as they collect signatures on a paid basis. So those are your highlights. And then in terms of your section analysis, Section 1 requires chief petitioners to notify the Secretary of State's office if they are using paid signature gatherers for prospective petitions. Prospective petitions require 1,000 signatures, valid signatures, in order to receive a ballot title, and folks can submit up to 2,000 that will count toward the total signature count to qualify for the ballot. If chief petitioners decide later to use paid petitioners in the prospective petition process, they must notify the Secretary of State's office within 10 days. Section 2 prohibits paid signature gatherers for collecting signatures on prospective petitions unless the person registers with the Secretary of State, completes the training program, and provides a list of all the prospective petitions and petitions on which the person will gather signatures. Essentially, what these provisions are doing is applying the IRMA requirements of registration to the prospective petitions process. Section 2 also gives election staff an additional 3 days to do backgrounds checks, and it gives the SOS staff the authority to use the law enforcement database to do these background checks. That would give us a total of 5 days to do the background checks. It prohibits paid signature gatherers from volunteering to collect signatures at the same time they are paid. As you know, from the passage of IRMA, we hold paid signature gatherers to a higher standard. It closes that loophole with IRMA. Section 3 requires the Secretary of State office to prepare templates for prospective petitions as well as initiative petitions. The prospective petitions shall be available within 3 days of the prospective petition being properly initiated. Section 4 applies the paper signature language to the prospective petition process. Section 5 holds chief petitioners liable for the actions of paid signature gatherers when they, quote, should have known there was an elections law violation. Current law only requires actual knowledge. It would apply to prospective petitions, and this section, as well, doesn't apply to criminal penalties. Section 6 does the same thing for contractors. It holds them liable for the actions of paid signature gatherers when they should have known that there was an elections law violation. Current law requires actual knowledge, and it would apply to prospective petitions, and it doesn't apply to criminal penalties. Section 7 prohibits a person, other than the signer of the sheet, from changing any of the information on the sheet of the prospective petition. Section 8 requires the signature gatherers to turn in signatures on a monthly basis. Gives the Secretary of State's office the authority to adopt rules to enforce the provision, and it allows for statistical sampling to begin if the signatures reach at least 50% of the required signatures. Section 9 provides the statutory authority to withdraw the petition prior to the verification of the total number of signatures. Section 10 provides the authority to impose concurrent civil and criminal penalties. Right now, if we choose criminal enforcement with the high burden of proof, we are excluded from pursuing civil penalties.
This proposal would give us the full range of tools to enforce the law surrounding the initiative process. Section 11 states that Section 12 becomes a part of ORS 260. Section 12 says if the SOS determines during the signature count that the person who obtained the signatures has been convicted of fraud, forgery, or ID theft, or has violated certain election laws, the Secretary of State shall not count the signatures that that particular person collected. Sections 13 through 15 are dates of application. Section 16 allows the Secretary of State to prepare office to prepare for the changes, make rules changes, and put systems in place for all of this to happen. And Section 17 would be your emergency clause. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to Margaret Olney. I also wanted to introduce on my right, I have Amy Wilson and Summer Davis, who are here as well to answer any questions that the committee might have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. My name is Margaret Olney. I am Special Counsel to Attorney General John Kroger. And one of my areas of oversight is in the elections arena, and is an area in which I have practiced extensively prior to my current role. The Attorney General shares Secretary of State Brown's concerns about the initiative process and particularly around signature gathering. I think I actually do need my glasses on. Oregon voters overwhelmingly approved of Measure 26 about 6 years ago in order to try to restore integrity to the initiative process. And since that time, the Secretary of State has been working hard at implementing Measure 26, coming up with procedures so that the process is as self-regulating as possible and that the unlawful activity is stopped in real time. Those efforts, I think, from the perspective of many, has not been particularly successful. I think that's due to a couple of things, the lack of resources in the Secretary of State's office and some sort of legal flaws in the existing laws. Complaints alleging illegal activity with regard to signature gathering often takes months, if not years, to get resolved after the election has come and gone, after a measure may have qualified, and that basically is not a sufficient disincentive to the folks who are involved in this process to crack down on the variety of problems that people on the street have seen through the years. Today in my testimony, I'm not going to go through each section. Secretary Brown has ably done that. I wanted to speak to three key components of the bill and also some potential legal challenges that have been raised by that. I'm aware that Legislative Council prepared a letter identifying some constitutional concerns. That letter was shared by Secretary of State Brown with the committee administrator. And so I would like to address those concerns.
And we have
here.
Copies for the entire committee at the end, so you can have a look at that request as well. So let's go first.
First, I would like to highlight how essential the concurrent civil and criminal enforcement is that is set forth in Section 10. Currently, actually, the law is really quite bad. If a violation is alleged that could be subject to criminal prosecution, then that is the only way to penalize and enforce that violation. So it is an either or. If it would constitute a felony, a criminal violation, then that is your method of enforcement. There is not concurrent civil enforcement. So even if the Attorney General's office, and that's who we've used, so these matters get referred to the Attorney General's office, they do an investigation. Even if the Attorney General looks at it and says, "Boy, it smells," but I don't think we're going to be able to prove in a court of law beyond a reasonable doubt that this circulator engaged in fraud, then that is the end of the Secretary's enforcement mechanism. There's no ability to say we believe this happened and enforce it through a civil penalty. And that has really tied the hands of the Secretary of State in terms of enforcing it. It is much more expensive to investigate and prosecute something criminally. It is very difficult to to convict. A case in point would be a situation where we had a circulator who an organization that I was previously associated with had contacted a number of the people whose names were on the who allegedly signed, and had affidavit after affidavit that that person was out of town, that there were a variety of problems. And the judge, when that was brought before the judge, said, you know, I believe that these signatures are not genuine, but I cannot find beyond, you know, I cannot conclude that it was this circulator who collected it unlawfully. It could be somebody else who just signed the circulator's name. So it showed that it was very difficult to prove fraud, that circulator engaged in that. But I would venture to say that in an administrative process, in the civil enforcement, I think that many would feel that there was adequate proof that circulator had engaged in misconduct and issue a penalty. The second piece that I would like to speak to is the rolling turn-ins, and those are set forth in Sections 8 and 9. Section 8 specifically authorizes the Secretary of State to require monthly turn-ins of signature sheets, and once 50% of the required number is submitted, the Secretary may, but is not required to begin the verification process. The Legislative Council has raised the question as whether or not the requirement of rolling turn-in is consistent with Article 4, Section 1, Sub 2, Sub E of the Oregon Constitution. That's a section in the Constitution that provides that a petition shall be filed in, to quote, not less than 4 months before the election. Thus, I think that the challenge would go, chief petitioners have the constitutional right to hold the signatures until that deadline. With all due respect, I think that is not how a court would analyze it. The Constitution specifically authorizes the legislature to enact laws not inconsistent with the mandates in Article 4, Section 1. And here the rolling turn-in leaves intact the constitutional deadline for submitting signatures, not less than 4 months before the election. I think that not less would be viewed as a deadline for submitting the signatures, as opposed to giving chief petitioners a right to hold on to the signatures. The third area has to do with the registration training of all petition circulators. As Secretary Brown indicated, House Bill 2005 seeks to build on the changes that were enacted in House Bill 2082 in IRMA. And it does so by basically filling in some gaps. And here, Legislative Council has suggested that the regulation of circulators would run afoul of the First Amendment because it would essentially infringe the circulators' free speech rights to engage in petitioning activity. And certainly, the Supreme Court has indicated that the actual act of communicating, of circulating, of paying people to circulate is protected activity. But the court has also been clear that, as in virtually all election laws, the state is free to regulate that process in a way where the regulation is not directed at the core communicative aspect of the speech, but rather the process. Thus, in a case before the Ninth Circuit in Pret versus Bradbury, the Attorney General was successful in defending Measure 26 against challenge, and there the court recognized that how you pay somebody, is a permissible area of regulation because individuals still get to engage in the communicative aspect. Here, and I think the same analysis would apply to all of the provisions of both IRMA and of 2005. I will let the committee know that there have been challenges to IRMA, none of which have been successful to date. There was a challenge to enjoin implementation of it back in, it would have been December of 2007, and the court denied that, and that was in Marion County. There was a challenge in 2008 8 in the spring relating to some of the implementation, and the court denied a preliminary injunction on that. There is pending a federal court challenge, and the Attorney General, certainly while we never want to, we recognize that there's always room to lose, and we might. we think we have a very strong case in moving forward on that. But I did want to alert the committee that there are legal challenges there. I think that the concern about regulating petition circulators kind of gets lost. We're asking these people to do important public, to do something that is very important. And just as we regulate lawyers, we require lawyers to be trained, we require lawyers to take tests. I mean, we regulate people who engage in important public services. And I think that it is entirely permissible to regulate the paid circulators in that fashion. Similarly, the chief petitioners, again, the goal, I think, of a lot of this legislation is to facilitate a system where chief petitioners and everybody involved really takes ownership of the process, doesn't say, somebody else is doing it, and I'm going to leave it to them, is to have ownership. And the provision of knew or should have known is really very familiar. It's very akin to the doctrine of respondent superior, that employers are generally going to be liable for the conduct of their employees unless there is some kind of intentional misconduct that they could not have known about. And that's all that I think that it should have known is really attempting to reach here, so that we encourage and we create incentives for chief petitioners and everybody involved in this process to safeguard it and to do it right. So with that, I think that we are all open to questions.
Okay. Questions? Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've got me a little confused now about the rolling turn-ins, because I hear you say it's constitutionally okay to hold to not less than 4 months away, hold the signatures. But yet, if somebody did that, you believe if they went to court, they would be ruled against for holding them. Have I got all this put together?
Gerard, I think I may have misstated then. The Constitution says that petitions must be turned in not less than 4 months before the election. So that's a deadline. I think it is entirely permissible to require signatures to be turned in advance, so long as you continue to accept signatures up until that four-month deadline. The other sort of piece about this, and I think this came up during the special session when there was some talk about Kevin Mannix's bill initiative on Measure 61 being withdrawn, is what happens if signatures are put forward and are in? What happens, does the chief petitioner have the ability to withdraw and not move an initiative forward? Currently, my analysis is that and the position that the Secretary of State has taken historically, is that if the signatures are turned in to the Secretary of State, they're no longer sort of under the control of the chief petitioners. What chief petitioners can do is control whether or not an initiative is going to be put forward by simply not turning in the last batch to make the threshold. And that has happened in a number of circumstances that I'm aware of. The danger of the rolling turn-in would be if things are turned in, what happens? Is there an ability for the chief petitioner to basically call it off? And we included the Secretary of State included a provision expressly here to allow the chief petitioner to withdraw that petition up until the time that enough signatures are verified. So we are protecting that right of chief petitioners to control that process. So it's not out of the hands of the chief petitioner, but we are giving the Secretary of State the ability to, in a much more deliberate, timely fashion, manage their workload, conduct the review, and ensure an orderly process.
Just a quick follow.
Absolutely.
So if I'm interpreting what you're saying, then you're just kind of building the firewalls for the process. You're keeping the process contained so that the Secretary of State maintains some kind of control?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, I would probably explain it a little differently. And as Ms. Olney explained, the constitutional framework requiring the signatures be turned in, I see as sort of the framework, like the structure of the building. And I believe, as the Secretary of State's office and as the legislature, you have the ability, I would use Secretary of State's office to do the rules, as the legislature, you have the ability to essentially put the walls and the windows in. And as the Secretary of State's office, in terms of the rules, I get to put the furniture in. So the Constitution provides the framework, sets the maximum or the minimum, and we can work within that. That's how I would describe it.
I think you said the same thing.
Good.
Thank you, Madam Secretary.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, if you'll indulge
Absolutely.
Me. Margaret, I see you. On page 6 of the bill, section 5, that has the provision for, or should have known rather than had knowledge, okay? Mm-hmm. Is, as should have known or should have knowledge, is that a legal standard that's defendable, that is understandable, or did you make that up? This question comes out of a floor debate this morning
right.
on exactly that kind of language and whether it has, I mean, and it wasn't this language, but a similar thing where I had similar questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, the knew or should have known is a commonly used standard in a variety of legal arenas. And I'm trying now that I say that, I'm like, I want to be specific because it feels so familiar, but I'm searching for the exact, and I could follow up with that.
Yeah,
we would like that.
I don't want to put you on the spot
yeah.
here, but I would like to, that's one of my questions about this language, is are we setting some new legal standard that is not defendable, or you wouldn't want to try and explain to a court. My
yeah,
second
well,
question
yeah,
has
yeah.
to do with the timing. Section 13, are there people gathering signatures as we speak who would be caught in a bind in this timing? In other words, they're gathering signatures under one standard, we pass a bill like this, and this kind of applies, I think, to all of the things that we're looking at over the next week on this. You can't change the rules in the middle of the game for people, so I would like to know what you're doing about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, and I hear exactly what you're saying, that we don't like to change the rules in the middle of the game. I will point out to the committee that under House Bill 2082, we did exactly that. For example, we changed the templates in the middle of the signature gathering process for 2008. So I do think we need a little work on the date and the timing, but let me give you a really specific example. There are prospective petitions out there now being gathered. I would not anticipate that this law would apply retroactively to them. We have to obviously get the bill passed through both chambers and the governor's signature, and then we will have specific dates applying moving forward. But for folks out on the streets right now for prospective petitions, we would not expect certain provisions of the bill to apply to them.
Okay. We'll pursue that later.
We may have
thank
to look
you.
At that one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Other question, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Chair. Section 8 requires a chief petitioner to file signature sheets with the Secretary of State every month. Once 50% of the required signatures are filed, the Secretary will start counting and verifying the signatures. Are these signature sheets going to be held confidential by the Secretary of State, or are they going to become public?
Great question. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Summer Davis. Before I did that, I wanted to point out
Some of the advantages to the petitioners, chief petitioners, in having the monthly process happen, and that is, first of all, we will be able to have a sense, particularly when they've met the 50% line, of whether or not they have enough signatures qualified. So what happens a lot of times is folks turn their signatures in at the very end, and they don't have enough signatures, but they've also run out of time. This would provide them with the opportunity, presuming they get their signatures in early enough, to collect additional signatures and ensure that their measure gets on the ballot.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, currently, as under this bill as well, the signature sheets are public record the minute that they are turned in. We don't necessarily provide them to public requests because we are working with them, but they are public record. There is no exemption under the public records law.
Representative Jensen.
The bill doesn't provide a verification process for signatures that are challenged. Do you think it'd be a good idea to provide citizens who have signed a petition an opportunity to verify their signature when it's been challenged as invalid?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's a great question, and one the federal courts recently addressed in the Lemons versus Bradbury case this year. We've had an intense discussion in front of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government on this particular issue. But in short, I will respond as this. I think we would all think it would be more fair to give citizens the opportunity to either cure or challenge signatures within the signature verification process. What I've talked to some of your colleagues about moving forward is when there are a very narrow amount of when the petition is very close to either getting on or getting off, or the referral is very close to getting on or off the ballot, that under those circumstances we would go through a signature by signature actual verification, which they do in Washington. As you might imagine, it's extremely expensive. The state of Washington says it's about $40,000 to $50,000 for every initiative, and it would require a constitutional change because our office would need more change to do the actual signature verification. In short, to give citizens the opportunity to either cure or challenge signatures would blow apart our statistical sampling method, and I'm happy to have Ms. Davis explain the statistical sampling method to you if that would be helpful. But we are very interested moving forward with a solution to problems when ballot measures or referrals are either close to getting on or not making to the ballot.
Do you want to have an explanation of the statistical sampling that they do?
No, I'm aware of statistics.
Okay. Okay. I thought it would be so much fun to have.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I understand it. I just can't explain it. So.
But if you want to have it explained, stop by sometime when I get. I have maybe one more.
Okay.
I might, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
In Section 12, the Secretary may not count signatures if the person who gathered the signatures has been convicted of an election law or rule under ORS, et cetera, sort of thing. What types of violations would prevent someone from gathering signatures? And could an administrative or clerical error, such as a late filing, having to amend a filing or having to amend a filing, be considered a violation?
I didn't hear what he said in the second question. Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, your first question is what types of violation would prohibit someone from being a paid signature gatherer?
One from gathering signatures.
A paid signature gatherer.
Yeah.
Okay. Three criminal violations: fraud, forgery, or ID theft. And that was part of the Initiative Reform Modernization Act that we passed last session, House Bill 2082. and you would be prohibited from doing becoming a paid signature gatherer under those circumstances.
I am to take that to be a negative then, as far as a late filing or a having to file an amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, you are correct. In Section 12 of the bill, it refers to ORS 260-993, which are criminal violations, and ORS 260-995, which are other civil penalties that are non-campaign finance related. So if you were to have a late filing, a late CNE transaction, it would not prohibit you from being paid to gather signatures on a petition.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Secretary, in Section 8 sub, or excuse me, yeah, Section 8 sub 2, the part that we were talking about just a few minutes ago, if it says on line 29, if the Secretary determines that the total number of signatures filed under this subsection is at least 50% of the required number of signatures, the Secretary may begin to determine whether the petition contains the required number, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Why may versus shall?
Chair Roblin, Representative Edwards, the reason that we're doing that is it would depend on the time when people turned it in. So if you turned your 50% in right before an election, it wouldn't make sense to verify that, to begin verifying. We're going to need to bring in extra staff. And so depending on when somebody turns in their signatures, it may not be prudent for us to start ahead of time. We maybe should just do it at the end when they get to 100%.
Sure. I'll take that as sufficient for now. I got to think about it.
Representative Garrard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Secretary, how many lawsuits have been filed against the Secretary of State's office, let's say, in the past 5 years over the initiative process?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, over the last, against the Secretary of State's office?
Yes, ma'am.
I'll have to get back to you on that one, Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard. I know that there have been about 33 convictions for fraud over about the last 10 years. I don't know how many lawsuits have been filed against the Secretary of State's office. I can get that number and, of course, the amount of dollars we've spent in Department of Justice fees as well.
Quick follow-up.
Correct.
I was concerned when you made the statement at the beginning of your dissertation in regards to returning confidence of the populace to the people. I'm trying to get my arm around, why are we doing all of these changes? Can you define that return confidence statement for me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, for me, and at least the Oregonians that I've talked to as I've traveled around the state, it's about restoring integrity into our initiative system and making sure that there's no fraud and abuse in the signature verification and gathering process.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions? Is that a quick?
No, that was a just okay.
I guess what I would ask, we have the copy and we'll send it out right now of all of the concerns that were addressed by the Legislative Council, and I would hope that all of you or groups of you would be available as we go on with this hearing at the next couple of days to answer questions that may come up. And I guess the hope for me was that people got a clear idea from the people who drafted this legislation about what it was supposed to do, and today's hearing was about that. And we're going to hear from other people, pros and cons, the general public at the next hearing. And we would love to have you available to answer questions at some further points along the way. And then we're going to have a number of other bills, and we're going to look and see how those may affect this as well. So any questions at all from our people? I want to thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, yes. Thank you very much.
And is there any other business? That's the entire group that we're having today to come talk to us. So we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2005. And again, Friday we do have pretty much a full schedule, and Monday the next with respect to this, and it may be it will take some more than that. Another announcement yesterday in the Senate Rules Committee, they passed out the Senate Bill 10, or and now it's Senate Bill 30. So it is heading our way, and we expect that that will be coming to this committee at some point in the future. Senate Bill 30, which is the refix of Senate Bill 10, the ethics bill.
Passed, going to do that when?
It passed out of the Senate Rules Committee yesterday. Should be on its way here.
Three times as much fun, Mr. Chair. Right?
Just wanted to give you alert that that's what's going on.
It's okay if I don't refer it down.
I know.
No, okay. We've got to do something. I hope they did something.
No, he didn't bring one. I didn't get one. So is there any other discussion or impetus? We tried to get out so you could guys go to your other meeting. I try to plan these pretty well. So with that, we will adjourn our rules meeting for today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.